Today's Old Testament lesson takes us back into history, back to the time of the Persian Empire and the reign of the Persian king Xerxes the Great, 486 to 465 BCE. This, you may know, is after the siege of Jerusalem, after the Babylonian captivity that followed. Under a new empire, the Persian Empire, some Jews have returned to their homeland, others remain part of the diaspora, carrying on with life outside of Israel. Some even married, settled, and made their homes in Susa, the capital of Persia, living as a recognized religious minority in the very heart of the powerful Persian Empire. That includes Queen Esther, the heroine of today's story. Now, that a Jewish orphan would somehow end up first lady in Persia is in itself, quite the story. Let me recap it for you. When the queen of Persia, Vashti, lost favor with Xerxes, she failed to show up at one of his parties, his advisor suggested staging a contest to find a replacement. They gathered all the most beautiful young women in the Persian Empire, and after 12 months of beauty treatments, each of the young women was sent to the king. As it would happen, a Jewish orphan named Esther wound up being the king's favorite, so he crowned her as the new king. Her cousin Mordecai, who had raised her after the death of her parents, was a minor bureaucrat in the palace, and he warned Esther, "Keep your Jewish heritage a secret." It's quite the rags-to-riches story. But life is never easy, even for those who live in palaces. Trouble soon develops. Not long after Esther's coronation, Haman, one of the king's chief officials, became enraged at Mordecai, Esther's cousin, for a perceived slight, and so decided to kill both him and all the Jews in the empire as well. Haman convinced Xerxes to allow a decree to be issued that all the Jews be exterminated. This catches us up with today's lesson. A royal notice has been sent out. In less than a year, all the Jews in the Persian Empire are to be annihilated. Now, this news seems to have eluded Esther, who is no doubt preoccupied with all the business of being queen, maybe redecorating the palace, welcoming dignitaries, maybe hosting banquets. But her servants notice her cousin Mordecai, mourning in sackcloth and ashes outside the palace gate. They tell Esther what they've seen. When she learns about this, she orders new clothes for Mordecai. Find that kind of interesting. Kind of out of touch, hey? You see someone weeping outside the gates. What could they need, right? Maybe a new outfit, a new suit. Well, Mordecai isn't impressed, and he refuses to wear the clothing. Finding her gift rejected, Esther sends an attendant to find out what's troubling him. Mordecai explains to the servant that the Jews in Persia are in peril, that there has been an edict of extermination endorsed by her husband, the king. Then he tells the servant to have Esther intercede with the king for the people, for her people. Now, when Esther receives the message, she's shocked and replies to Mordecai that he doesn't know what he's asking. Even though she's queen, she doesn't have the freedom to initiate contact with the king. Barging in on the king is punishable by death. As we heard, if he doesn't raise the scepter, she will be the one who will be dead. She adds that the king hasn't called in on her for more than a month, all to say that Xerxes may have lost interest in her anyways. She wasn't his first wife. She might not be his last. Esther tells Mordecai that he doesn't know what he's asking for. But Mordecai responds that he does. He doubles down and warns her that she herself will not be immune from the extermination order. He warns Esther, the cousin he raised as a daughter, and then he asks her, the orphan Jew who became queen. Who knows? Maybe you were made queen for such a time as this. Maybe you were made queen for a time like this. Esther's in a tough spot. When she was in her running for the queen, Mordecai advised her to keep her family background a secret. Now that she'd won the Persian lottery, now that she was queen of the empire, Mordecai was asking her to risk her place and her position by opening up about her minority family status. We can imagine Esther thinking, "Who? Me? I don't have any power or authority. I'm just an orphan Jew who doesn't really even belong here. I'm just faking my way through each day. How about someone else? Can't some passionate prophet step up and do it? Maybe one of the Lord's priests. Surely there's got to be someone else in the empire that can deal with this issue." Well, whatever she was thinking, in the end, Esther concluded that she needed to take action. She sent a message back to Mordecai asking him to gather the Jews in the capital and to have them fast for her. Afterwards, she would go to the king. I encourage you to read the rest of the story. It's an interesting story. There's lots of delicious ironies, lots of great reversals. Instead of the Jewish people being exterminated, they have an amazing victory over their enemies. It's a good read. But more than entertain us, I think this story is intended to challenge us and inspire us. I mean, Esther can go a long way in teaching us about ourselves. When she took part in Persia's version of the Bachelor TV show, her cousin told her to keep quiet about her family. Well, have you ever been told, warned, not to stick your neck out? Don't cause any problems around here, especially when you're new on the scene trying to make a good impression. In her palace, Esther had no idea about that edict, that is, until her cousin brought it to her attention. Well, how many things do we sort of miss in our local city or in the world around us because we're just so busy, caught up in our own concerns? Like Esther, we've learned to keep our heads down, keep our noses clean. Like Esther, we are often too preoccupied with our own world to notice the needs of others. But like Esther, we are sometimes challenged. Sometimes challenged. Challenged to notice the problems of the people around us. Challenged to, just get out of our comfort zones and do what we can. I mean, think about that challenge of Mordecai. Maybe you were put in your place for a very time like this. Have you ever considered this question? Maybe you were put in your place for a very time like this. We tend to look at our work or our families as opportunities for our own joy and fulfillment. We work hard. We work hard to create havens where we can enjoy simple, quiet, happy lives. But could it be that these roles, our vocation, our family life, create opportunities for daring acts and courageous decisions, standing up for what is right, standing against what is wrong? Could it be, aside from all that haven, family life, enjoyment of what's good, that in fact, standing up is why God has put us here? Well, let me tell you another story. This is a children's story. the story of Ruby Bridges. And some of you may be aware of her story. It's not imaginary. It's a historical piece. Ruby Bridges was born in a small cabin near Tylertown, Mississippi. "We were very, very, very poor," Ruby said. "My daddy worked picking crops. We just barely got by. There were times when we didn't have much to eat. The people who owned the land were bringing in machines to pick the crops. My daddy lost his job, and that's why we had to move. I remember us leaving. I think I was 4. In 1957, the family moved to New Orleans. Ruby's father became a janitor. Her mother took care of the children during the day. After they were tucked in bed, Ruby's mother went to work scrubbing floors in a bank. Every Sunday, the family went to church. We wanted our children to be near God's Spirit, Ruby's mother said. We wanted them to start feeling close to Him from the very start. Well, at that time, black children and white children went to separate schools in New Orleans. The black children were not able to receive the same education as the white children. It wasn't fair, and it was against the nation's law. In 1960, a judge ordered 4 black girls to go to 2 white elementary schools. 3 of the girls were sent to McDonough 19. 6-year-old Ruby Bridges was sent to first grade in the William France Elementary School. Now, Ruby's parents were proud that their daughter had been chosen to take part in an important event in American history. They went to church. "We sat there and we prayed to God," Ruby's mother said, "that we'd all be strong and we'd have courage and we'd get through any trouble, and that Ruby would be a good girl and that she'd hold her head up high and be a credit to her own people and a credit to all the American people. We prayed long and hard." Well, on Ruby's first day, a large crowd of angry white people gathered outside the France Elementary School. The people carried signs that said they didn't want black children in a white school. People called Ruby names. Some wanted to hurt her. The city and state police did not help Ruby. The President of the United States ordered federal marshals to walk with Ruby into the school building. The marshals carried guns. Every day for weeks that turned into months, Ruby experienced that kind of school day. She walked to the France school surrounded by marshals, wearing a clean dress and a bow in her hair and carrying her lunch pail. Ruby walked slowly for the first few blocks. As Ruby approached the school, she saw a crowd of people marching up and down the street, men and women and children shouting at her. They pushed toward her. The marshals kept them from Ruby by threatening to arrest them. Ruby would hurry through the crowd and not say a word. The white people in the neighborhood would not send their children to school. When Ruby got inside the building, she was all alone, except for her teacher, Mrs. Henry. There were no other children to keep Ruby company, to play with her, to learn with her, to eat lunch with. But every day, Ruby went into the classroom with a big smile on her face, ready to get down to the business of learning. "She was polite and worked well at her desk," Mrs. Henry said. "She enjoyed her time there. She didn't seem nervous or anxious or irritable or scared. She seemed as normal and relaxed as any child I've ever taught." So Ruby began to learn how to read and write in an empty classroom, an empty building. "Sometimes I'd look at her and wonder how she did it all," said Mrs. Henry. "She went by those mobs and sat there all by herself and yet seemed so relaxed and comfortable." Mrs. Henry would question Ruby in order to find out if the girl was really nervous and afraid, even though she seemed so calm and confident, but Ruby kept saying that she was doing fine. The teacher decided to wait and see if Ruby would keep on being so relaxed and hopeful, or if she would gradually wear down, or even decide she no longer wanted to go to school. Then one morning, something unusual happened. Mrs. Henry stood by a window in her classroom and, as she usually did, watched Ruby walk towards the school. Suddenly, Ruby stopped, right in front of the mob of howling and screaming people. She stood there facing all these men and women. She seemed to be talking to them. Mrs. Henry saw Ruby's lips moving and wondered what Ruby could be saying. The crowd seemed ready to kill her. The marshals were frightened. They tried to persuade Ruby to move along. They tried to hurry her into the school, but Ruby wouldn't budge. Then Ruby stopped talking and walked into the school. When she went into the classroom, Mrs. Henry asked her what had happened. Mrs. Henry told Ruby she'd been watching and that she was surprised when Ruby stopped and talked with the people in the mob. Ruby became irritated. "I didn't stop and talk with them," she said. "Ruby, I saw you talking," Mrs. Henry said. "I saw your lips moving." "I wasn't talking," said Ruby. "I was praying. I was praying for them." Every morning, Ruby had stopped a few blocks away from school to say a prayer for the people who hated her. This morning, she forgot until she was already in the middle of the angry mob. When school was over for the day, Ruby hurried through the mob as usual. After she walked a few blocks and the crowd was behind her, Ruby said the prayer she repeated twice a day before and after school. "Please, God, try to forgive those people, because even if they say those bad things, they don't know what they're doing. So you could forgive them, just like you did to folks long time ago when they said terrible things about you." The book has an afterword, and it goes on to talk about how later that year, two white boys started attending school as well. Their parents were tired of them sitting around home and missing out on an education, so they sent them there. The boys went. There was lots of protests, too. People didn't want that to start happening, but eventually the protests wore out. And what Ruby and her family did, well, they were able to accomplish what they had intended. Now, I've read the story more than once, so I've had a little time to reflect on it. I'm pretty amazed at the courage of Ruby, as I'm sure you are, but I'm also amazed by the courage of her parents. I mean, when the opportunity arose for Ruby to be one of those children challenging segregation, they could have taken a pass. "This isn't for us. This isn't for Ruby. Let some other family be the trailblazers." When she faced those angry protesters, they could have said, "That's it. That's enough. We've done our part." But they didn't give up. They persevered in their courage. They saw this as a challenge they could take on with the support of their community and their God. They strike me as people who are like Esther. Courageous people who recognize that God had put them in a place, in a moment, where God's purposes could be moved forward in the world. Well, may we all be like Ruby. May we all be like Esther. May we recognize we are where we are because God has something important for us to do. Amen.